Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Many thanks for joining us. So, Hillbilly Elegy. The J.D. Vance story is getting a new round of attention due to the recent release of the Ron Howard film adaptation. In this hour, we have a couple of takes on this. First, an essay in The Atlantic by Kentuckian Cassie Chambers Armstrong. She talked with Tom Eblin about the essay and her own book about life in the region.
J.D. Vance's book, Hillbilly Elegy, which has been made into a movie, has generated a lot of controversy in Appalachia. It has prompted others to write their own memoirs of growing up poor in Appalachian families and draw very different conclusions about the region's problems and solutions. One memoir that has received a lot of praise is Hill Women by Cassie Chambers Armstrong. Armstrong grew up in Berea, but she spent a lot of time as a child with relatives in Owsley County who found ways to draw strength from their disadvantages. Armstrong writes about the strong women in her family who helped inspire her to pursue higher education at Yale College, the London School of Economics, and Harvard Law School. Armstrong returned to Kentucky to give legal assistance to poor Kentuckians suffering domestic violence and a court system that has often been stacked against them. Armstrong is now a lawyer, law professor, wife, mother, former vice chair of the Kentucky Democratic Party, and recently was elected to Louisville's Metro Council. She's with us today to talk about Hill Women. Cassie Chambers Armstrong, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, great. Well, what prompted you to write this book, and what do you want readers to learn from it?
You know, I don't think I ever realized that I had a story worth telling until 2016, whenever really Hillbilly Elegy and other portrayals of Appalachia started getting so much attention in the national media. The portrayals that I was seeing out there, they didn't really resonate with my experience growing up. And so I wrote Hill Women largely to respond to that and sort of try to put out a more positive, hopeful representation of Appalachia, because that had been my experience growing up there. And what I think a lot of people in my family and in my immediate community thought the world needed to see from Appalachia.
Well, how would you contrast your book with Hillbilly Elegy?
You know, I think Hillbilly Elegy is one person's story, and I always think it's a good thing for individuals to tell their story. But where I really begin to take issue with it is when J.D. Vance begins to talk about moral failings of individuals and sort of talk about this bootstraps type of narrative as Appalachia is a place that is sort of dirty and broken and poor, and this thing that he has sort of risen above. And in my experience, you know, there certainly is poverty in Appalachia. There certainly are problems. But a lot of the problems stem from failings of systems, not individuals. And even though there's a lot of challenges and a lot of things that we need to work on, there's still a lot of hope there. And I think that too often we don't take time to sort of see the hope that exists in these struggling communities.
Well, what are some of the things that you think he got wrong about the region?
You know, I think in general, his focus on just sort of the negative feeds into this idea that Appalachia is a place that's either not worth saving because the problems are so deeply entrenched, and it sort of gives people outside of Appalachia an excuse to write the region off and sort of say, you know what, I don't understand people in Appalachia. A lot of times it becomes political. You know, I don't understand why they voted for Donald Trump. I don't understand why these deep-seated problems haven't been fixed. And so I'm just, you know, I'm not going to care about their problems. I'm not going to try to understand. I'm not going to try to engage. Or if they do decide that they want to get involved and help, they tend to think that, oh, this is a place that needs saving. This is a place that I, as an outsider, need to come into, and I need to make it better. And, you know, surely this community couldn't address its problems without me. And I really believe that, you know, Appalachians, they're creative, they're resourceful, they're hardworking. There are some of the smartest people I know living in the mountains. And if we could find a way to just support those local leaders and give those communities the resources that they need, they're perfectly capable of solving their own problems. And I think the way J.D. Vance shapes his narrative sort of precludes that as an option.
Well, since returning to Kentucky, you've gotten involved in politics. And what are some examples of how you think that government should be doing a better job of helping people in Appalachia improve their communities and lives?
Yeah, I think in general, focusing on really those kitchen table issues, I've spent a lot of time sort of traveling to rural communities trying to help rebuild the Democratic Party there, because historically, Eastern Kentucky has such a strong tradition of labor and a strong tradition of workers' rights and strong economic programs. And we've seen in sort of recent decades that that has slipped away. And so I've spent a lot of time going to Appalachian communities and sort of saying, you know, what is it that your community needs and what are you not feeling like you're getting from us? And a lot of times, you know, it's people feeling like for years and years and years, politicians of both parties have made promises and have said they'll make things better. And they feel when they look at the rest of the world, like their community isn't making progress. In fact, they feel like they're sort of backsliding by comparison. And so I think that was the real appeal of Donald Trump, was this idea of someone who would just burn down the entire system because they felt like neither party was really serving their interests. And so I think it's going to be very interesting to see how the politics of Appalachia change in sort of the post-Trump era, and how sort of a Democratic Party that speaks to those kitchen table issues in Appalachia might resonate differently than it has in recent years.
Well, at its heart, your book is really a personal story, and I'm curious what you learned in the process of writing it.
You know, I think one thing I learned is just how sort of fallible memory is. It's a memoir, and in some ways, I thought writing a memoir would be easy. It's not like a research paper. You don't have to go out and sort of look into footnotes and sources and all of that. And my approach was really, let's sit down with my family and talk about how they remember things and what they think is important to explain our family's journey and progress and all of that. And in the process, I just realized how totally differently we remember things, you know. I would swear Granny's wedding dress was brown. Someone else is like, no, it was blue. No, it was absolutely green. And it's just amazing sort of how people who all sort of heard the same stories, experienced the same events, remember everything differently. And it's a nice reminder that we all have our own truth in the world and we all have our own story.
Well, of the various people you write about, tell us a little about a couple of them because they're very vivid characters.
So the book traces three generations of women in my family. It starts with my granny, who, you know, had a third grade education, grew up in a large family, never really had a childhood because she grew up in an era where children started working as soon as they were old enough to do so. And even though she didn't get to get an education, she was only able to go to school through third grade. She really wanted to have a child that graduated high school and went to college. And so, you know, some other characters in the book are those children. My Aunt Ruth, who was the firstborn girl in the family, sort of really wanted to graduate high school, but also wasn't able to because of family circumstances, having to help out on the farm, some health issues. But she was sort of the best tobacco worker in all of Owsley County and became this real, like, strong person that sort of held the family together and encouraged my mom, who was another of Granny's children, the sort of second girl born in the family and one of the younger kids, to be able to pursue her education. And because of that, my mom was able to become the first in her family to graduate high school and go on to college, largely because she had these two other women in her life who were really pushing her to go forward and get an education and sort of saying, we didn't have the opportunities, but we are going to work to make sure you do, and you better take advantage of them.
Well, one opportunity you have coming up is you were recently elected to the Louisville Metro Council. And the experience of writing this book and the experience of your family in Eastern Kentucky, how do you think that will change how you do your job as a council member?
You know, I really believe in the power of government to change lives, in part because I did grow up sort of in a family that didn't have a lot of resources. And I benefited from a lot of government programs, healthcare programs, you know, programs like SNAP and all of that. And I think it made me realize, like, government, it really can and should be a force for good. And it's also something that I've seen in sort of the generations of my family. And I think local government is really the level of government that's closest to the people. It's sort of the one where you're actually out helping people one-on-one with the things that really make their day good or bad. You know, is their sidewalk fixed? Do they feel like they can navigate their city safely? Do they feel like they know their neighbors and that there's a sense of community? And I really believe that government at its best sort of starts at the local level and builds up. And so I'm really excited to be able to try to foster a sense of community here locally in Louisville, because I truly believe that the community I had growing up is the reason that I was able to have the opportunities that I did.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And the book again is Hill Women by Cassie Chambers Armstrong. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Eblin interviews on Eastern Standard are provided in partnership with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning. We've been noticing in comments on social media threads about Hillbilly Elegy, the film, this recurring wish that there was some alternative portrayal of the story of thousands of Appalachian families leaving their homes early in the 20th century, hoping to find work in the industrial cities of Ohio and other places in the North. And along with them went a rich tapestry of traditional and original music.
Fare you well, Kentucky girl, my time has come to go. Going to make my living there, across the Ohio, across the Ohio, across the Ohio. Going to make my living there, across the Ohio.
Well, there is such a film. It's titled The Mountain Miner, and this song, Across the Ohio, is its theme, composed by the film's writer and director, Dale Farmer, who drew on the experiences of his own family who, during the Depression, moved to Ohio to find work.
It was very important for me to show a positive side of Appalachia and the Appalachian people. I grew up in the suburbs of Fairfield, Ohio. Most of my neighbors and schoolmates and family and church members, we all had roots in Appalachia. And these were all very hardworking, moral people that had really made their way in life and were doing well. But the Appalachia I see in movies is almost always based on the stereotypes of ignorance and drug use and alcohol use and violence. And it's an easy target for Hollywood, I believe, to show the Appalachians in that way. But that is not the Appalachia I grew up in. It was a very good upbringing and very positive, and so many of us were very educated and fit into society very well. And so I just wanted to show a positive side of Appalachia, the side that I grew up seeing.
Farmer's film portrays the story of that job-seeking migration to the North with music at its core.
When I was growing up and first hearing this music, there was a particular sound that just really grabbed me. It was haunting. I couldn't put my finger on it, but it was just something that when I heard it, it just took me to a place that I had never been before. I felt like I was back in the mountains of Kentucky when I heard it. I finally found out that kind of music was called the Mountain Miner.
That's M-I-N-O-R.
It's really based on a banjo tuning, where to go from a major happy key to a minor key, you take that third tone and lower it a half step. And then it just gives you this sadness. But if you take that third tone and instead raise it a half step, it just has this mysterious sound to it. You're playing in a suspended chord the whole time. And the fiddle, a good fiddle player will play right between the major and minor and not really be on both when they're playing together. And it just gives you this sound that's it's just a mysterious sound. And being in that suspended chord, you just are always ready for it to resolve itself, and it never does.
That music was about a whole lot more than just entertainment, Dale Farmer tells us.
I grew up hearing stories of my grandpa, and one of the things he often told me was, when I was growing up, I had three things: work, church, and the fiddle. And the fiddle was pretty much their only form of entertainment. And if it wasn't for having a fiddle to play and going to church and hearing the church music, they would have no music in their life.
Its soundtrack of 39 songs is what advances the story of making that wrenching decision to pull up roots and move north to find work. And the authenticity of how that is portrayed is the distinguishing mark of the Mountain Miner.
For so many of us old-time musicians and other people that are really familiar with the music, most movies use actors who are pretending to play, or they do play, but they don't have the nuance and the lifetime of experience playing this music. It's not part of their soul, and that comes across on film. And we wanted to do something very authentic, and so we used real musicians to play the parts.
Performers like longtime veteran of folk and bluegrass music, Ma Crow.
I play Ruth Abner, which is the grown-up version. You'll see two kids that are musicians. That's Charlie and Ruthie. And then when I appear in the movie would be like 50 years later.
And old-time music legend Dan Gellert.
I play Charlie, who's retired and wants to go back to the old home place.
As you view the Mountain Miner, keep in mind that these are musicians, most of whom had no experience in front of a camera.
None, zero. But I did leave with great respect for actors. It's not an easy job.
And for musicians like Ma Crow, the storyline has a familiar ring.
My parents left Tennessee. I was born in Ohio, but they would send me back to Tennessee to stay with my Aunt Sally all summer long. So I had that experience also about going home for the summertime, and they'd come get us when it was time to go back to school.
In my way, I've sort of done the same thing, moving back to my wife's hometown here in Aiken, South Carolina.
Musician Dan Gellert says acting was at first quite a challenge for him, but once he became familiar with the storyline, something clicked.
It just felt like I was trying to do what I think I'm trying to do with the music that I play, to be a conduit for the sources that I'm learning from.
Rounding out this cast of musicians turned actors are Asa Nelson, Elizabeth Leprell, Mike Oberst, Hazel Paisley, and Trevor McKenzie. Director Dale Farmer.
As the music migrated with the people across the Appalachian Mountains and into West Virginia and into Kentucky and Virginia and North Carolina, the isolation of the people caused the music to evolve in different ways. So over a long period of time, you can hear a tune played in West Virginia or Kentucky or North Carolina, and they'll all be just a little bit different. There's just a nuance of the Kentucky style. It's the bowing might be a little different. The accents might be a little different. It's just like hearing someone talk. We all speak in English, but we all just have a little different accent according to what part of the country you're from. And the music is kind of the same way when it comes to the old-time fiddle styles.
The story told by this film and its rich score serves as a reminder of who and what we are in this country. Dan Gellert.
American culture, it's a gumbo, it's a mix. We really are, all of us, we're a Creole culture, and that there's certainly a big root of that mountain music that goes straight back to Scotland and Ireland. But there's also a major root that comes right out of West Africa. And there's a lot of German, there's Norse, there's even Italian that's in that mix.
And as Ma Crow reminds us, you can take the girl out of the mountains, but you can't take the mountains out of the girl.
My heart was always in the mountains. No matter where I lived in the United States, Tennessee was always home. No matter even if I was born in Ohio, Tennessee was always home. Still is.
You can learn more about the film online at themountainminermovie.com.
Cross the Ohio, cross the Ohio. Going to make my living there across the Ohio. Cross the Ohio. Cross
Coming up after the break, the pros and cons of teaching by Zoom. And one household, much poetry and music. We talk with Lexington poet Carrie Green about her new collection of works, Studies of Familiar Birds, and her husband, Transylvania professor Scott Whitten, about his collaboration with faculty at UK and EKU on the two-volume album of instrumental songs from quarantine. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson, Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, and Kayla Combs provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and personal injuries. More information at 859-777-7000.
Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Since the pandemic was formally declared back in March, we've been tapping into its effects on that crucial fundamental of human growth and development, education. Cynthia Reeser is back with another in this series.
Today I'm talking with Trent Catlett, and he's an EKU junior from Louisville, Kentucky. And Trent is majoring in history, and he's also earning his high school teaching certification, and he's an officer in EKU's History Club. So Trent, in the last 7 months, learning online has become a regular thing in K-12 schools as well as for college students. And you're training to be a teacher. So first, tell us what you like most about online learning technology.
It's really helping me develop better traits as I prepare myself to become a teacher. You know, before this pandemic hit, I really didn't use Zoom or Google Classroom. And ever since the pandemic, that's all I've ever used is Zoom and Google Classroom. So it's kind of taught me proper like Zoom techniques and how to use the internet as best as possible and what kind of strategies I can use while I'm teaching, you know, using Google Classroom to my advantage, using Google Forms, just trying to utilize the internet and technology to my best capability. And I feel like it's also helped me collaborate with other teachers that I couldn't before in person. So I feel like the internet and the technology has helped a lot with my progression as a teacher.
Listeners may not be familiar with some of the things you can do with Google Classroom. Could you give us a few specific examples of the things you've been able to do with that?
You can do a whole lot of things with Google Classroom. There's like a stream where you can upload all the assignments. You can interact with the students. You know, you can share slideshows with them on there. So it's just a really good interactive tool to use, you know, with not being in person.
So it's definitely more than just a search engine. It's sort of a repository where you can put digital versions of all the things you would have done in a face-to-face classroom, right?
Yes, ma'am.
What are some of the disadvantages to virtual learning?
I think the disadvantages is just that human-to-human connection. You know, it's hard trying to stay interactive on Zoom or on Google Classroom because, you know, if you're in person, you can see how the students and teachers are interacting with the material. Whereas on Zoom, you just see everybody, you know, slouched back in a chair or a couch or whatever they're doing, or maybe with even their cameras off. If the cameras are off, you know, you really can't do anything. And so you just really lose that human connection that you would get in person. And online, you know, it's just text or a video.
Yeah, I agree. I'm suffering from the same things teaching online at the college level. It's hard to connect to people, isn't it?
Yes, it really is. And that's kind of the only thing I really haven't liked about online teaching, you know, with my clinicals. I just haven't really got to make those connections to students where I would have if we were in person.
Right. A casual conversation really isn't something you can do easily online.
No.
Of course, COVID-19 has impacted our lives in many other ways in addition to our schooling. Tell us a little bit about how it impacted you this summer and fall and the choices you've made.
Well, this summer it kind of impacted me because, I work at a Chick-fil-A in Louisville. So, I had to learn real quick how to wear a mask before wearing a mask was mandated. And so I kind of got used to that. And really, I would just go to work and come straight back home because I wanted to keep my family safe and myself safe. So, and I think we planned on going on a trip, but we didn't get to do that, of course. And at school in the fall, it's affected me because, like I said, with all the classes going online, and then I have two jobs on campus, and I used to work at the Chick-fil-A on campus, but I kind of decided it was in my best interest for myself and for my family's safety to not work there, just so I don't come in contact with all the students on campus with the rising COVID cases. And I have a job at the archives here at the library, and I'm kind of isolated there. So it's just a safer opportunity here, and it also helps me more with my historical degree.
So you're interacting with historical documents and artifacts instead of people.
Yes, ma'am. It's a lot safer.
I think so. As a historian, what kind of insights have you developed in this past few months?
Well, it's crazy to see this pandemic going on because, as students, we always learned about the Black Plague in the Middle Ages. You can't really imagine that in your head because it's such a broad topic. And whenever this pandemic started, it's just like, wow, this is what people went through back in when the Black Plague was happening. And it's hard to imagine because when I worked at Chick-fil-A over the summer, one of my coworkers, she asked me, how do these plagues usually end? And I told her I couldn't really give you an estimate because, back in the Black Plague, that's hundreds of years ago. They didn't have the technology we did. You don't ever really think about this in the classroom after the presentation's over with. You're just like, okay, what's the next subject? But now we're actually living through a pandemic. And it's interesting to see how the governments, not only in our country, but all over the world, how they're trying to handle this pandemic and what kind of policies and practices they're going through to try to contain this pandemic.
And I think you made a really good point that while there are similarities, our technology and scientific medicine give us a lot more insight and a lot more chance of surviving than the folks did in the Middle Ages.
Right. They thought the way to cure that was to kill all the cats in the Black Plague, and that only amplified it because, it was really the rats who had, was carrying the Black Plague.
Yeah, good point. So if you were already a history teacher and you were teaching history to high school students this year, what would you try to make the main theme or the main takeaway for your students?
Well, the main takeaway I would try to teach my students is just to see how, governments are handling this. Because that's a very important policy, because you can see some countries are, thriving. Like they have more, they're having in-person concerts. They're doing a lot of better than a lot of other countries are. And, it's important to see what kind of government, these countries are having. Are they having a democracy? Are they having a dictatorship? Because, some countries are handling this a lot better than others. And really, it's because of their government and how their people are interacting. In American history, it's important to see what's going on during this pandemic. Like, not only is there this pandemic going on, but we also have a social justice movement going on as well. And I would really like my students to focus in and just really take note of what's happening around them, because this is going to be history in the future. Like, we will be teaching this. Not only is the pandemic going on, but there's also the election. And I would like my students to also focus on, which candidate is going to give them the best option to handle this pandemic.
Those are all good points. And I think you're going to be a great history teacher.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Trent.
Oh, not a problem. I appreciate you having me on. And thank you.
Let's take a pause for poetry.
Bird in a bell jar. Bird in a bell jar. The rain can't reach you here. can't plump your shriveled skin or bead on your bright beak. The flies can't burrow, the worms can't tunnel inside your flaxen core. No breath blurs the jar or keeps the moths from flinging themselves at celadon light, their parchment-thin wings unable to break the hush of glass. Bird in a bell jar, bird cloistered in silence, if I cut my ear to your cold shroud, will your song echo back, faint as waves, haunting a shell's pearlescent cave?
That's Lexington poet Kerry Green with background music provided by J. Tom Nato and Kerry's husband, Scott Whidden. And we'll hear from Scott Whidden as well in just a few minutes. Kerry is reciting a work that went on to become the theme of a new book of poetry revolving around something many of us are experiencing in these times, grieving the loss of a loved one. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Kerry Green.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
It's nice, especially in these times, to engage in an art form that, in my view, gets way too little attention on the radio, and that's poetry, and how it helps us understand and appreciate the world around us. We certainly could use a lot of that right now. In the words of Alice Osborne, poetry's strength lies in its ability to shed a sideways light on the world so the truth sneaks up on you. Is that how it works for you?
Yeah, I really like that quote. I haven't heard it before, although Emily Dickinson has a, kind of a similar quote about, you know, tell the truth, but tell it slant, which I also think describes poetry really well. Yes, absolutely. That's definitely how it works for me. I often feel that if I'm concentrating too hard on trying to say something, that's when a poem is almost certain to fail. So it's when you're kind of, you're focused on image or rhyme or sound or something. And in my case, it's often focusing on a piece of art that allows me to speak a larger truth.
Has it always been this way for you? How early in your life did you actually begin writing poetry?
Well, I definitely wrote some poetry in school, in high school and college as well. I went to graduate school for my MFA in creative writing. My MFA is actually in fiction, but I was writing poetry all along as well. And I was lucky to go to a creative writing program where I was able to take just as many poetry workshops as I was fiction workshops. So poetry has been a big part of my life for a long time.
Well, going back to that quote from Alice Osborne, that the truth sneaks up on you. What truths do you illuminate in the collection of poems contained in Studies of Familiar Birds?
Wow. Yeah, that's a tough question. I think it's hard, to articulate myself what truths may be in the poems. I think one of the things I was trying to do in writing the poems was to understand grief, and not just my own grief over the death of my father, but also I was using another family's story to try and understand their response to grief. So hopefully people who have experienced some sort of loss would find something that's true to their experience as well.
Well, as it happens, another fellow poet, Amy Fleury, says of your work in this collection of poems, Green writes with such grace and skill that the reader can't help but feel both the ache of having lost and the joy of having loved. I will return to the book again and again as it teaches us to sing our grief. Did Amy Fleury capture your intent with that observation?
Well, I I don't know that it was necessarily my intent, because, you know, when you're working on poems, it may be a little bit different than someone writing a novel, or I don't necessarily have a full story or, you know, a full plot in mind when I'm writing. I'm just working poem to poem, and seeing how they all become in conversation with each other. But I was really happy to read what Amy had said about my book, you know, after the fact, because that was something that I hoped for, that both joy and grief would be in the poems and visible to the reader. Because certainly I think one of the reasons why we grieve is because we've experienced joy with the people that we love. And those two emotions are so twined together.
Okay, I'm going to put you on the spot, Carrie. Do you have the book in front of you there?
I do, yes.
Okay, I'd like to ask you to read a selection. What have you chosen for us?
I'm actually going to read the poem Ode to the Mourning Dove, and Amy actually is quoting this poem in that quote of hers. And this poem is based on a plate from Illustrations of the Nests and Eggs of Birds of Ohio. And that's the book that many of the poems in the book are based on. And this was the first book of its kind to be published about American eggs and nests. And it was begun by Genevieve Jones, who started the project. And unfortunately, just a few months into the project, she died suddenly at the age of 32 of typhoid fever. So her mother and her family ended up taking the project on themselves to completing it in her honor. And so most of the poems in the book are about the plates, the illustrations that her mother, Virginia Jones, completed. And this is Ode to the Mourning Dove. How can we not love your nests? Each twig an offering from male to female as he stands upon her back. Such economy, the way the heft of your bodies molds the sticks. Spare, we should say, not crude, not flimsy. Please forgive us for finding your tiny heads so comical above your plump, delicious breasts. But how we covet the blue rims lining your black eyes and your tranquil coloring amid summer's dazzle of emerald and ruby flight. We rest our eyes on the soft grays of your wings, the rosy buff of your chests. But mostly we adore the rattle of wind through your wings and how, when dawn's chatter rises to cacophony, we can always discern your throat's pulse. O dove, the sweet ache of your lament. Teach us to sing our grief.
Wow, that's so beautiful. And I think anybody who has heard the call of the dove can hear what you're saying there. And, you know, we kind of have this tendency to impose ourselves, our characters and personalities on all creatures, to anthropomorphize. You resist that temptation. Instead, you are honoring your subjects, like the dove, the pigeon, the wrens, the owls, herons, hummingbirds, among the many. And I take it that was intentional.
Yes, it was. It was kind of difficult, considering the fact that, I mean, I think that is our tendency, to try and see something that we're familiar with in something wild, in an animal. And at the same time, I was using the source text, Illustrations of the Nests and Eggs of Birds of Ohio, that was written in the 19th century. And they very freely anthropomorphized the birds in the text of that book. So I was definitely having to work against that. You know, that was another thing I was pleased to see someone say about my work, that I was resisting that temptation, because I do think it's important for us to learn things from animals, but to not try and impose our reality on them.
Imagine if they reverse that.
Yes.
So you close with a beautiful tribute to your father.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you choose to send us off with Song for My Father?
You know, I felt like when I was arranging poems on my floor, which is how I tend to order poems, that poem kind of gave it the arc. And, you know, the poem that I just read about the mourning dove, you know, ends with the lines, "Teach us to sing our grief." And I think that's what I was trying to do in the poem, in the book as a whole, is learning how to sing my grief. And so that final poem is called Song for My Father. And even though I think other poems in the book are also songs for my father, you know, this one deals specifically with songs. He was someone who had a beautiful voice and sang in church a lot. And it just, I think, spoke to who he was and to what I was trying to do, I guess, with the book.
Do you have a website? And if you do, what's the address?
I do have a website, and the address is mynamecarriegreenpoet.com.
That's C-A-R-R-I-E, Green.
That's correct, and it's green like the color.
All right. Carrie Green is author of Studies of Familiar Birds, her latest collection of poems published by Able Muse Press. Thank you so much, Carrie.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
We have so much talent in our region with its two public universities, UK and EKU, and the private Transylvania. It's easy to take all this for granted, and rarely are we treated to an artistic cross-pollination of talents from these three institutions, but we're going through rare times right now. And it's in times like now when creativity often blossoms. One result is music. And here to tell us about one project is Transylvania professor and guitarist-songwriter Scott Whidden. Greetings, Scott.
Hey, Tom.
So, Songs from Quarantine, Volumes 1 and 2. First, give us the lineup. Who is involved in this project?
Archipelago is made up of Dr. Kevin Holm Hudson, who's over at University of Kentucky, and Dr. Jim Gleason, who is at EKU. I serve at Transylvania. We also have some collaborators from far and near, such as Neil Bell, who lives in Memphis, Tennessee, Wyatt Nicholson, who lives in Athens, Georgia, and Dave Heyman, who lives up in Georgetown.
And so the name of this group is Archipelago. How did you all come around to that title?
It was sort of a wonderful little accident in a sense. I was reading something. It may have been in the paper. It may have been in the New York Times or something like that, as we were at the beginnings of this project. And an archipelago is a series of islands. They're separate, but they're connected in terms of geography, in terms of reacting to the same conditions. And that's kind of how, when I saw that word, I thought it was exactly what we were going through, not only as musicians recording remotely, but also as people going through this pandemic. We're all affected by the same conditions and responding to the same things, but we're also connected in terms of how we're doing those things.
Uh-huh. And the title, Songs from Quarantine, that implies that you didn't gather in a studio. So I take it that you all did everything online?
Everything was done through distance and through the benefits of technology and with the helping hands of Jim Gleason, who served as producer. Each of us have basement studios and attic studios and home spaces, and we were able to collaborate via a variety of techniques. And it's been an amazing process. I never realized that the way we recorded this would shape the aesthetics of it. And that turned out to be pretty much exactly what we needed in terms of this time.
Let me just ask you to expand on that for just a minute. How did it shape the aesthetics?
Well, Tom, you're a musician too. And a lot of times when you're writing, you might have people in a room and they're responding to things such as eye cues or body movement, or you're able to say immediately what you like and what you don't, or how to cut things or how to build things. In a way, working like this slowed down time a little bit, which I guess is rather fitting given a pandemic, that once a file was sent, we worked everything to a click, everything was done to a Dropbox folder, you kind of had to sit with it for a little bit and think about it. And so I might send a guitar line or a set of chord changes, and then Kevin might respond to that. And the way he interpreted it was sort of like looking through a prism, that you would get a sense of some light being refracted and some light coming through, and you'd see what you did in a whole different way than you never expected. And that's what I really appreciated about the collaborative spirit of the project.
That's interesting. Now, you're releasing a second collection of songs, and we'll talk about how to find that in just a moment. But first, let's get a brief sample from Volume 2. False Sources is the title of this piece. Tell us about that title.
As we were writing and editing and composing and listening, one of the things I was doing is I was sort of keeping an eye out for phrases that were repeated in various media sources since the pandemic began. Mm-hmm. For example, the phrase lungs like glass I saw in a New York Times at a feature about a person on a ventilator. It was really early in the process and that phrase stuck with me. So I knew that was going to be one of the titles. False Sources was a phrase that I saw repeated in a number of media sources. And I realized that it's sort of fit the mechanical electronic feel of the song as a whole.
That's a passage from False Sources, a track on the album Songs from Quarantine Volume 2, and we're talking with one of the artists performing this music, Transylvania University professor Scott Whitten. Scott, you're making this music available for sale with all the proceeds going to Central Music Academy. Why CMA?
First, I'm blown away by all the nonprofits in this town. One of the things that I think makes Lexington Lexington is the degree of impact and positivity and joy and service that nonprofit work does. But I'm especially impressed by CMA. CMA has given over 40,000 free music lessons to students in need since 2004. When Jim and Kevin and I started talking about this project, we realized we wanted it to be in support of a nonprofit program, and CMA just seemed to be the logical choice. They inspire young people to think about music. They help people expand in terms of music horizons, musical creativity, and they help create community. And that's what this project was about from the beginning.
So Songs from Quarantine Volume 2 has just been released. How can our listeners find it?
Well, we are available on Spotify and Apple Music and other platforms, but we'd really encourage folks to check us out on Bandcamp. So if you go to archipelagosongs.bandcamp.com, you'll see links to volumes 1 and 2. You can stream for free, you can download, and if you'd like to make a contribution, every little bit helps and all of it goes to CMA.
Transylvania University's Scott Whitten, who along with EKU's Jim Gleason, UK's Kevin Holmes Hudson, as well as Neil Bell in Memphis and Dave Heyman in Georgetown, make up Archipelago, original instrumental music inspired by this quarantine experience we're all sharing. Now let's head to LaGrange, Kentucky for a bright spot in this tough year. That's where two young girls are encouraging people to come together using two words, be kind. Here's WEKU's Sherry Lawson.
The first thing you see driving into LaGrange, Kentucky, is a sign right at the city limits.
Welcome to LaGrange, kindness capital of Kentucky.
That's 9-year-old Rylan and 12-year-old Reagan Richens. They inspired local leaders to designate the city as the kindness capital. Rylan says she and her sister wanted to make a difference in their community. She says they got an idea when they saw a sign in a nearby county with the words, "Just be kind." Rylan says while driving home from a trip, the family was hungry and cold.
And we were not in the best mood, and then I see the sign, and it's fun with lots of pretty colors. That just made us so happy. We just wanted to start doing it here.
She says the girls asked their mom if they could make yard signs for people that read, "Be kind."
Then I said, even if we do it, we just start with 40 signs. And Reagan said, how about 60? Then next thing you know, 1,000 signs later, we're huge.
In the past year, the girls have painted close to 3,000 signs. On this day, the girls are shaking cans of blue, pink, and green paint at a picnic table in their backyard. They're decorating the one-of-a-kind signs while Mom Rhonda cheers them on.
Oh, that looks awesome, Rylan. That looks like cotton candy.
Thank you.
I know that's
even though the Richens family has 5 kids, 3 with special needs, Mom Rhonda says she had no hesitation supporting the girls, but admits she had no idea how big the project would get. Now they have a website and Facebook page.
This is a project of love, and people are kind to us because we don't profit from this. None of the money goes in our pockets. It goes back to the community.
7 local charities benefit from the Be Kind campaign. The girls charge $10 for each sign. 12-year-old Reagan says they started making the signs so their county could become closer.
We felt that every place could use more kindness because there's never too much kindness.
The signs placed in yards and businesses in the Kentucky county have had a ripple effect. The mayor of LaGrange, John Black, says people across the country have reached out to ask about the campaign, especially during these divisive times.
Just a couple little girls had an idea and a special place in their heart to try to create this kindness effort throughout our city and our county, and it's somewhat taking hold more so than just here.
The family has heard from a Rotary Club in Pennsylvania, a scout troop in Michigan, and a family in California. Just several of the 3,000 emails and calls about the Be Kind campaign that the family hopes will spark a wave of kindness across the country. For NPR News, I'm Sherry Lawson in LaGrange, Kentucky.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on air, online, and on mobile at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest a topic? You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.